You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a journalist who's been covering Mike Pence for a decade about the meaning of his career as vice president, especially the incredibly rocky end of his term. Now, with people largely staying home because of COVID-19, it might seem like this would be virtual reality's time to shine. After all, if you can't fly out to Hawaii or Europe or whatever, maybe the next best thing would be to put on a special headset and bring those exotic destinations to you. But our next guest says, unfortunately, VR technology isn't what sci-fi movies taught us to hope for, that those fully immersive experiences that put us in another dimension with all kinds of superpowers still aren't there. But sales of virtual reality headsets are up big time during the pandemic. There's some travel apps that let you wander around national parks. There's games, exercise programs, too. So will virtual reality technology ever reach the point where we feel like we've really been transported to another world? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried this stuff out? Do you have one of those headsets? Have you ever tried a virtual reality app maybe during the pandemic? How'd it work for you? Was it cool or a headache, figuratively or literally? And do you have questions about this technology, this still emerging technology? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kevin Roos is a technology columnist for the New York Times who's written about virtual reality. Kevin, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I was excited, you know, as a science fiction reader about the potential for virtual reality. You were more excited than I was. You actually bought one of the earlier incarnations, the Nintendo Virtual Boy in the 90s. How'd it go?
Yeah, this was the very, very early days of, I don't even know if you could call it virtual reality. I mean, this was a Nintendo product that had a life of about 6 months, I think, before it got shut down because it was a sort of catastrophic failure. But it was a very early incarnation of what became virtual reality, the idea that there would be a computer that you would sort of strap to your head and that it would take you into an immersive world where you could play games or watch movies or hang out with your friends or, you know, exercise, all the things you mentioned. And so I was really optimistic about this. I was very excited when, you know, for the day when this would be super realistic and you'd be able to kind of disappear into this other virtual dimension. But I think what we've seen over the years is that, you know, there's a sort of core group of VR people who really believe in this technology, but it hasn't really caught on in kind of a mass way yet.
Yeah, virtual reality is always just around the corner, and then it keeps being just around the corner in a lot of ways. Why hasn't it? I don't, what are the challenges that have kept it from being something that, you know, not just those specialty types want, but that the general public is going to want?
Well, I think for a long time there were technical limitations, and there still are some. I mean, there are, you know, the early virtual reality headsets, you could only wear them for, you know, maybe half an hour before you start to get a headache or, you know, your eyes would kind of cross and they were not very comfortable. The newer headsets have solved some of those problems, but there's still sort of a barrier there. It's less comfortable to look at a virtual reality headset for extended periods of time than it would be to, you know, look at your phone or your computer screen. But I also think there's kind of an interesting thing happening, you know, in kind of 2D virtual reality. So I spend a lot of time playing video games and doing sort of, you know, Zoom calls with my friends, you know, playing board games over the internet with, you know, my family members. So I think during the pandemic, we've all discovered these kind of ways to inhabit virtual worlds. It's just that not many of them involve strapping computers to our faces. They're, you know, taking place in video games and Zoom calls in more traditional ways.
Talking to Kevin Roos, technology columnist for the New York Times, about the technology of virtual reality, the headsets that are out there, the limitations, and some of the potential for good stuff coming out of them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried a virtual reality headset for fun? Did you buy one? Do you exercise with it, play games? Or did you just put it away in the corner, let it gather dust? 800-642-1234 is the number to call with your comments and questions. Now, state of the art today, Kevin, you've written about some cool stuff you can do with it, including you've been doing some virtual reality exercise programs. What's going on?
Yeah, a couple months ago, I started using this app on my Oculus headset called Supernatural, which is basically a workout app. And the way it works is basically it's a game where, you know, you are standing in some, you know, impossibly beautiful place. You know, you're on a mountaintop, or you're in, you know, the desert or a placid lake somewhere, and these kind of orbs fly at you, and you have to kind of hit them in time with music. And there are, you know, you have to squat, and there are places where, you know, it's sort of like a, like if you remember Dance Dance Revolution, that old game where you had to kind of dance different patterns to the beat of music. It's kind of like that, but in virtual reality. And it's actually a pretty good workout. I do it a couple times a week, and it's become one of the primary ways that I get exercise. Now, would I choose it over, you know, going to the gym? Probably not, but we can't go to the gym right now. Gyms are all closed. So maybe the next best thing is working out in VR.
And you did mention some concern about what the neighbors might think if they saw you wearing this weird helmet and batting at invisible things.
Yeah, that's the biggest drawback with working out in VR is you look like a huge dork when you're doing it. But, you know, my wife laughs at me, and you know, I sometimes do it outside on our patio. And, you know, I sometimes worry the neighbors are going to call the cops about this, you know, guy waving his arms around and squatting if you can get over the aesthetic part of it, it actually is quite a good workout, and I find it works pretty well for me.
Well, let's name some names about the products on the market that people might encounter. I know when I watch football, I see ads for one of these where you can put on the helmet and do some, you know, Star Wars adventuring and things like that. What's on the market that's the state of the art right now?
There are a number of companies that are making VR headsets. Probably the market leader is a company called Oculus, which is owned by Facebook. Facebook acquired it several years ago, and they're sort of they're selling the most headsets. Actually, for big parts of last year, you couldn't order them because they were on back order. So many people are buying them. So they've sort of become the kind of standard bearer of kind of the mass market VR experience. There are high-end VR headsets that cost thousands of dollars that, you know, you connect to high-powered computers, and those are the ultra-realistic ones. But the Oculus is sort of the mass market one you can pick up for a couple $100 at Best Buy, and that's what a lot of people are getting.
I wouldn't want to buy a computer if there was, you know, not much software for it. Is there a lot of software for the Oculus and some of the other brands? Can I do cool stuff with it?
Yeah, they have their own app stores, you know, just like your iPhone or your Android. And so you can, you know, download games, you can download, you know, there are apps that let you kind of watch movies inside sort of virtual movie theaters. It looks like you're sitting in a, you know, in your local movie theater, but, you know, you're watching, you know, the latest Star Wars or something. There are apps that just let you, one app I really like is a fishing app where you can just go fishing. And it's almost meditative. It's like you're out there on a lake, and you're just, you know, you use your controller to cast your line and reel in your fish. And if you kind of do it for long enough, you can kind of almost feel like you're actually out in nature fishing. It's almost relaxing.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kim is with us in Fox Lake. Kim, hi.
Hi. So I haven't seen anything in super recent years, but I know that they were working on, like, technologies to help people, like, people that are blind sense color when they're hooked up with a helmet and whatnot, and also, like, transmitting ideas through the internet, like, they got somebody to, like, move their finger from miles away from where the person that was thinking it was. I don't think that we're going to get to that point in the VR world until we've overcome, like, these other things that we're working on, like giving senses to people that don't have all of them.
Kim, thanks a lot for the call. Is that something you've tracked, Kevin? Adaptive technology, I guess, with giving people who are blind the sensation of color with virtual reality, transmitting neural impulses, things like that. A little more science fiction, at least as far as I know.
Yeah, I don't keep super close track of that stuff. I know that some of these companies are working on sort of what they call brain computer interfaces. So things where you could control computers just by thinking things. And that's not sci-fi. That's that people are really developing that in labs, and Elon Musk and other people have talked about advances toward that kind of system. And, you know, there are accessibility and technology for people with disabilities is definitely something I think could be helped by this. And we already see, you know, people using, you know, robotic wheelchairs, text to speech software, people who, you know, have lost the ability to speak, that helps them a lot. So I think there are definitely applications of VR, that could help with that. One thing I think is really interesting is the use of VR in medicine. There are now, surgeons who will practice a surgery in VR on a virtual patient before they will actually go into the operating room and do it. And, you know, some surgeons I've talked to say it really helps them.
Kim, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about virtual reality technology and why it hasn't become mainstream and how it could be used in the future. Kevin Roos is our guest. He writes a technology column in the New York Times called The Shift. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the virtual reality technology on the market? Did you grow up with, you know, the holodeck on Star Trek Next Generation or the novels of William Gibson? Are you a little disappointed by the progress in the virtual reality world so far? Were you one of the people who got the Oculus and some of these other products sold out during the pandemic? How'd it pan out for you? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking a look at virtual reality technology, where it may be heading, with Kevin Roos, technology columnist for the New York Times. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried one of these headsets? Do you own one? How is it? Is it everything you'd hoped for and more, or a lot less? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to our callers. Bill is with us now in Green Bay. Bill, hi.
Hey there.
What'd you want to tell us about, Bill?
Well, I got a couple of them Oculus headsets. I got a Oculus Rift and Oculus Rift S. And I got to say, I'm pretty pleased with it. A lot of fun.
What have been your favorite apps, Bill?
Well, I like that Robo Recall. It's like a shoot 'em up type game, but also like Google Earth. That's really cool.
Now, Bill, before I let you go, I want to ask, there are some motion video games, you know, in two dimensions that make me a little, give me a little motion sickness. Do you ever have that while you're doing that shooter game with your virtual reality headset?
That particular game, no, but I know what you're talking about. And I find the key is to kind of look forward. Don't look at the screen itself.
Great, Bill. Thanks a lot for that call. So he's Bill is seeing, Kevin, some positive stuff. He's having fun with Google Earth and at least one game. Have you encountered either of those, and what do you think?
Yeah, I haven't played that specific game, but I have used the Google Earth app. I think that the two things that I've been enjoying the most in VR are exercise and, just sort of travel, almost you would call it. There are a number of apps that let you go to beautiful places, walk around in beautiful landscapes. It's almost like there's some guided meditation apps where you can just sit under a waterfall and have a couple minutes of just reflection and silence. And I think that to me is more useful. I find actually some of the games I've tried in VR to be almost too immersive. Like things are, it's a little scary. It can be a little scary when, a zombie jumps out at you or something. And it's right there. It's not like you're watching it on your computer screen. It really feels like you're there. So there's a sense in which, the more intense the experience, the sort of closer it gets to real life.
Thanks for that call, Bill. And we've been talking, I think, mostly about solo virtual reality activities. You took some social things for a spin, where the promise is, hey, you and your buddies or your coworkers or whatever, you're going to get together in this virtual space. It's going to be better than just audio or just a Zoom chat or whatever. What was your experience like?
That part of it was pretty underwhelming to me, I got to say. I think that I tried this app called VR Chat, where basically you have, you know, a little avatar that you can design. It sort of looks like you, and you can walk around and go to parties and talk with people. And there are various, you know, different clubs of people talking about, you know, they're people doing concerts and poetry readings, and it's sort of like they try to make it a kind of social space. And I found that just totally, that was sort of lost on me. I mean, most of the people I met in the VR chat app were, you know, sort of new to it too. And so most of the conversations were about chatting in VR. And it, you know, there was some kind of, you know, teenage type conversations happening. It just wasn't very fun. I would much rather talk with my friends on a Zoom call than talk to them, you know, over VR.
We're talking about virtual reality and the promise, potential, and shortcomings of the technology. Kevin Roos is with us, technology columnist at the New York Times. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you've been playing around with this stuff or not. So, Kevin, on the horizon, what are you watching for? Are there cool, or at least potentially cool, technologies or apps in the pipeline?
Yeah, I think the technology is going to continue to evolve. I think the most interesting question I have is actually who is going to be using VR. I know initially a lot of the, you know, the early adopters were people like me, were young men, people who are, you know, early adopters of a lot of technology, nerds, I guess you would call us. but one thing I've been seeing more and more, especially in this workout app I use, is a number of women are getting into it. People who are maybe older than the average VR user, you know, grandmas and grandpas are starting to get into it. So I think that's what I'm looking for. Is I'm wondering whether VR can truly expand into something that everyone uses, or whether it's going to continue to be sort of a group of early adopters.
Let's go back to our callers now. Brad is with us in Neenah. Brad, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Do you have one of these things, Brad?
Yeah, so I picked up a PS4 because I couldn't get a PS5 in the pandemic like so many others, and wasn't going to get the PSVR, but talked to a local GameStop employee, and he said Star Wars Squadrons was just unbelievable in VR, so I ended up picking one up, and I've been really impressed with how it performed and the whole experience of doing a Star Wars type game, flying an X-wing or a TIE fighter in VR. It's been pretty fun.
Wow, that's why GameStop stock went up so much. Brad, thanks a lot for that call. Kevin, that, you know, an existing platform like PS4, and I think this is the one I've been seeing the ads for so much, you know, you've got this console already, and you could just add VR on top of it as an option.
Definitely, and I think that's been a barrier for a lot of people for VR up to, you know, the past couple of years, is you needed a big fancy computer to run it. Now they have, you know, standalone headsets like Oculus, the Oculus Quest. There are also ones that, yeah, connect to gaming consoles that people might already have. So I think that's allowing it to sort of become a more mass technology. I think that, you know, most people don't have super high powered gaming computers. So I think that's a good thing.
Thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it at 800-642-1234. So do you think that the future of the market is going to be, you know, an Oculus type of thing where we're selling this headset, or is it going to be more of the porting over from the PS4, or do you see room for both?
I see room for both, but I think what's the big question in my mind is whether these sort of virtual reality experiences, these totally immersed, you know, computer on your head, you know, experiences, are going to become more popular, or whether it's going to be things like, I was really interested last year toward the beginning of the pandemic, there were a number of very popular events that happened inside Fortnite, the video game. So there was like a concert by this artist, Travis Scott, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions of people tuned into that inside Fortnite. So they were on their computers or their consoles. They were not wearing, you know, computers on their head, but they were still partaking in some kind of virtual world. And I think that's what a lot of people are feeling is, you know, they would rather, there are some drawbacks of VR, right? You can't, you know, do anything else. You can't, you know, you can't eat popcorn while you have a thing strapped to your face. You can't do it with someone sitting next to you on the couch. I mean, it's in some ways a solitary experience. So I think the advantage is still with these kind of conventional sort of augmented reality or sort of alternate reality events over the fully immersed virtual reality world. But I could be wrong on that.
It's time for one more quick call. John is with us in De Pere. John, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, John?
So I had purchased my first VR set. I got the PSVR in, I think it was August of 2020. And I had a really, really good time because my friends had never done VR. I had never done VR. It was really fun to just mess around in VR and have them try it too.
Hey, can I ask how old you are, John?
I am 14.
Okay, John, thanks for the call. Briefly, Kevin, maybe if that next generation of teens catches on, this might be more widespread. What do you think?
Definitely. I mean, I think we've seen, you know, that teens drive the way on a lot of technology trends. So, yeah, if in a couple years, every, you know, 16-year-old in America has, you know, spending an hour a day inside VR, I think we'll know that it's a dominant force that is going to spread beyond teens. I think it's partly going to be a function of how the technology goes. And I think it's probably going to be a function of what happens after the pandemic, you know, when we can all go back outside and see our friends and hang out in person, are we still going to, you know, want to strap computers to our faces and go on Google Earth?
John, thanks for that call. And Kevin, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Kevin Roos is a technology columnist at the New York Times. We talked to him about virtual reality and why it hasn't caught on as predicted and what may still be to come. Coming up, Mike Pence was loyal to a fault with President Trump. All that changed when the president pushed him to overturn the results of the election. Next up, we're looking at the meaning of that moment for Pence and for the Republican Party. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk with a journalist who's been covering Mike Pence for years about the meaning of his vice presidential term and the rocky ending. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg remembering baseball legend Hank Aaron and his time with two baseball teams in Wisconsin.
Baseball legend Hank Aaron died late last week at 86 years old. He had close ties to Wisconsin and its people, including my dad. Hank Aaron won the World Series with the Milwaukee Braves in 1957 when my dad was 7 years old. Later, my dad almost caught a foul ball off Aaron's bat at a game. He says Hammer and Hank's numerous home runs were sometimes line drive missiles that seemed to still be gaining altitude as they reached the bleachers. Aaron went on to break Babe Ruth's all-time home run record in 1974 after the Braves moved from Milwaukee to Atlanta.
One ball and no strikes. Aaron waiting. The outfield deep and straight away. Fastball is a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone. What a marvelous moment for the country and the world. A black man is getting a standing ovation in the deep south for breaking a record of an all-time baseball idol.
Aaron received a mountain of hate mail and even death threats as he approached the milestone. But in a 2012 speech at Marquette University, Aaron talked about staying focused through adversity.
There were many times when I wanted to give up, but I kept going and I learned that if you want something bad enough, you have to make the necessary sacrifices to get it.
He spent the last two seasons of his career with the Milwaukee Brewers and hit his last home run at Milwaukee County Stadium. Hank Aaron was thankful for his time in Wisconsin.
A little town called Eau Claire and the city of Milwaukee helped to shape my dreams and my life.
For more on Aaron's time in that little town called Eau Claire, here's contributor Dean Robbins.
Hank Aaron set lifetime records for home runs and runs batted in, among other mind-boggling feats. He and Babe Ruth are the only two players who rate their own rooms in the Baseball Hall of Fame. You might not know that Hank started his career in another Wisconsin city, Eau Claire. After signing him in 1952, the Braves sent the 18-year-old to the Eau Claire Bears, their Class C farm team. As a kid who'd grown up in Mobile, Alabama, Hank was unprepared for this northern town, and Eau Claire was just as unprepared for Hank. But a funny thing happened in the summer of 1952. Eau Claire and Hank Aaron got along. White families opened their doors to Hank. He got multiple invitations to dinner. One family basically adopted him. Like a lot of folks in town, they were big supporters of the Bears, and they felt real affection for the shy kid who began tearing up the Northern League on his way to a Rookie of the Year award. The family had a teenage daughter, and she and Hank developed a special friendship. The two of them used to sit on the porch holding hands, and the amazing thing is that nobody made a big deal about it. Of course, they didn't flaunt their relationship in public. The city probably wasn't ready to go that far. Still, as Hank said later, I was treated as fair as could be in Eau Claire. Compare this to the treatment he got on his next minor league team in the Deep South. Instead of invitations to dinner, he got slurs and death threats. As a black player, he wasn't allowed to share a dressing room with his white teammates, so he had to suit up for games at his segregated hotel. And yet he rose above it all with quiet dignity, just as he did throughout his major league career. To this day, Hank Aaron and Eau Claire get along splendidly. He's been back to visit several times, most notably in 1994, when the city dedicated a statue of him. Hammer and Hank was blown away by the reception he got from thousands of adoring fans. As he put it, a lot of things happened to me in my 23 years as a ballplayer, but nothing touched me more than that day in Eau Claire. Eau Claire natives are clearly proud of the big star who began his career in their small city. They should also be proud of themselves for treating the star-to-be with respect.
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. Special thanks to WPR reporter Rob Menser, who contributed to this story on Hank Aaron, who passed away last week. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, Mike Pence had a quick rise in conservative politics, from the U.S. House to the Indiana governor's office to vice president, and the possibility of a presidential run is still out there. But 4 years of Pence's loyalty to his running mate ended earlier this month, with Trump supporters chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," while storming the Capitol. Our guest says that Pence's years of extreme loyalty to the president were motivated largely by Pence's drive to become president himself one day, and the last weeks of Trump's presidency led to serious fracturing within the Republican Party, an event that can be understood in part by looking at Pence's tenure as vice president. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a Pence campaign for president in 2024? What do you think about his time as vice president and his handling of the coronavirus? Call 800-642-1234. Tom Lobianco is a Washington correspondent for Business Insider. He's the author of Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Lobianco has covered Mike Pence for a decade for the Indy Star and other publications. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, I want to start at the end in some ways. On January 6th, the Trump supporters are going into the Capitol after the president targeted Vice President Pence for not trying to overturn the election results. He doesn't call the vice president. He tweets another attack on him while this is going on. What's going through your head as somebody who's been following Mike Pence for so many years?
It was, I mean, to me, it was absolutely astounding. You know, in the run up to that, Trump himself had been pushing Pence pretty hard behind the scenes to try and overturn the election results. Basically, you know, attempt a coup. And constitutionally, Pence could not do that. That's not his role. That's not the way the Senate rules were, and not the way the Constitution has determined this. So it was impossible. And, you know, what happened inside there was Pence actually drafts this letter. And I'll be honest, like, you know, watching him through the administration and then reading that letter that he drafted on January 6th, where he wrote very definitively that no single person can unilaterally overturn the results of the election or decide who gets to become president. That was the most, like, actual Mike Pence, like the person who's buried inside there underneath the politics, the ambition, the calculation, all that, the positioning, the tacking, you name it. That's like the most of like the core of that guy, the one that I found when I was writing the book and while I was covering him, that I've seen, at least during his time with Trump. And he's, you know, he's very opaque. He's always been very opaque, but it shone through. And it kind of had me wondering, well, God, you know, where was that guy for the last 4 years? And then immediately after that, they stormed the Capitol. I mean, they're running in there to try and kill him, or at least that's what they said they were trying to do. It continues to astound me. I mean, I think around here, I'm in the suburb of Washington, D.C., and I know at least around here, we're still kind of shaken up by everything. So I don't know, man, you know, still a lot of things up in the air right now, frankly. I mean, we haven't even done the impeachment trial yet. I mean, among many other things.
Yeah, well, I want to go back to an earlier stage here. You wrote that in your book that Mike Pence had his eyes on the White House, not as vice president, but as president. He signs on with his Trump campaign, really thinking he's signing on for 4 months or so of association with Donald Trump. Not thinking he's going to win, but thinking he's going to set him up for 2020 yeah. to run against the incumbent Hillary Clinton. Talk about that gamble and how it didn't go the way he thought it would.
That's right. Yeah, you know, in July of 2016, detail it very micro detailed in the book, how it actually happened, how he gets selected. And there's a lot of, you know, maneuvering that he and his own people do to make this happen, which is something that you don't often see, at least in public, by Pence. He's got, you know, he's got his own ambitions, but he's also got his own tactics and strategies for achieving these things. And he's been very good at hiding them. So, you know, flash forward. So he ultimately gets the nod. And then flash forward to October 7th, 2016, when the Washington Post publishes the Access Hollywood tape, where, you know, Trump, then the candidate, you know, brags about being able to molest women as long as he has a Tic Tac. And then you have, 30 minutes later, they dump the John Podesta emails, WikiLeaks, Assange. And in that moment, the donors of the Republican Party have been going to then Chairman Reince Priebus and his staff, asking him, saying, you know, we need to get Trump off the ticket. Can we replace him with Mike Pence? And those donors make the call to Pence and to one of his aides and say, hey, we're ready to replace. We've got this contingency plan and we're ready to replace. We can call an emergency meeting of the RNC. We can replace Trump as the nominee with Mike Pence, and he would be the nominee, and that, you know, it will save us. And his guy says, no way. I'm not even going to bring this to Mike. Like, he's never going to find out about this. There's no way we're doing that. And you also saw in a different way, in a different event, Mitch McConnell basically say the same thing, that he wouldn't sign on to efforts to try and remove Trump as the nominee. And, you know, why was that? And as best I can tell, based on my reporting and, you know, kind of seeing things settle a little bit over the last few years and, you know, kind of see where the pieces fit together a little bit better, it's because everyone thought Trump was going to lose and they were all planning out their own political future. You know, I talked with a couple of people who knew about Pence's fundraiser going out to donors, Republican donors, and telling them in October of 2016, sign on board with us now and you'll have a seat at the table early because we're going to be the front runner for the nomination in 2020, which immediately presumes a Trump loss. And that's how they thought about things, you know. So on election night 2016, when Hillary Clinton's 1:30 a.m., give or take, on November 9th, and Hillary Clinton calls to concede, and Mike Pence turns to his wife, Karen Pence, and says, we won. And Karen refused, and he goes in for a kiss, and Karen refuses to kiss him. And she says, "You got what you wanted, Mike. Now leave me alone." And, you know, the first time I'd heard that anecdote, I was a little skeptical of it because they're a very careful political couple. They don't tend to let people see these things. They don't let themselves get exposed in public or in private, even really. But the more I thought about it and the more I talked with folks about this as I reported, the more it seemed like what she was really angry at was not Trump himself, but at Pence for taking this gamble. Because, you know, in a flash, they had gone from being stuck with serving with Trump for 4 months and then, you know, moving on to their own ambitions to having to survive 4 years. And I mean, as we all witnessed, it was a chaotic 4 years, to say the least. And Pence kept on getting roped into all of it. I mean, there's no way to duck that storm that was in there. And, you know, what did it result in? Ultimately, it results in people chanting outside the United States Capitol to hang the vice president. I mean, it's insanity. I hope we don't see anything more like that. Nobody should be putting death threats out there on people, you know, whether they're the vice president or the, you know, the Milwaukee dog catcher, who knows? Like, you just shouldn't be doing that. But I mean, in a sense, if you look at the sweep of it all, Karen Pence was right. You know, there's a lot of danger in that. You know, the risk and the reward seem to be unequal at this. You know, that does not seem to be properly balanced. And she, you know, I'll say this, Karen Pence really, and from folks I talk with, has some pretty sharp political instincts. Some people think they're better than Mike Pence's.
We're talking to Tom LoBianco, author of the book Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House, looking at Mike Pence's time as vice president, the rocky ending, and what comes next. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about Mike Pence's time in the White House. Tom LoBianco is with us, author of Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Let's talk about another chapter that happened after your book, Tom. COVID-19, mm-hmm. Vice President, then Vice President Pence, put in charge of Trump administration efforts to stop the disease, sort of. But a lot of other people seem to be in charge of it, too. What did you make of that chapter in his White House term?
Yeah, you know, when they announced it almost a year ago now, at the end of last February, if you can remember back that far, nobody thought it would be as serious as this. I mean, everybody was all focused on Washington State, you know, a couple of cases out there. And, you know, I remember there was kind of a hot take inside of Washington that this would be the thing that, you know, Donald Trump would use to blame Pence for everything and then replace him on the ticket with a woman. And that would help Trump win re-election. I hate political speculation because it ends up so wrong all the time. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when Chris Christie was the front runner for the Republican nomination in 2016, you know. I don't know. There's a couple things. There's a couple threads with Pence. And I think that when you think about him, this is what I was watching for when he got this. You know, he was not a very good executive when he was the governor of Indiana. He was highly indecisive. He didn't have a really good read on the legislature, how to interact with them. He didn't really have like a firm grip on things around there. Very apprehensive in his decision making. And he spent a lot of time, you know, frankly, running for the next job. He was, you know, out courting donors throughout his time in office, taking a lot of flights to New York and whatnot. And I kind of looked at this and, you know, he'd been inside the Trump White House. He'd more or less been subsumed. I mean, he had a couple of things that he focused on. He had South American policy, which is hugely important if you're going to run for office, if you're going to run for any nomination, because that starts to get you into Florida. You know, reminder that the Latino community down there is, you know, as much as it's, you know, Cuban refugees, increasingly has been more Northern South America, the old Gran Colombia, Venezuela, parts of Peru. And he had that as a portfolio. He got Space Force. That was kind of a new branch of the military. You got that. All this stuff gets washed over by Trump, frankly. But, you know, when he gets this, it's a high profile assignment. And I was kind of watching, okay, would he take, how would he lead, frankly? You know, if your question, like if this guy's ultimately running for president, your gauge of this is it's a really good chance to get a look at him and to get a sense of, okay, how would he lead as president? And I think his handling of the coronavirus is actually a pretty good indicator of what he would be like as president if he decides to run in 24 and if he should get the nomination. You know, it was very hands off. He spent a lot of time messaging everything. You know, some people inside there argued that the task was too big for him. He wasn't built for it. He wasn't ready to step in on big fights. Other people and the folks close to him around there would say, well, no, Mike Pence has a very hands-off management style. And I guess that, you know, it depends on what you're looking for. Now, you know, the results of this is that, you know, we've had one of the worst times of this across the globe. I mean, that's undoubted. And, you know, does that hang on him? Does it hang on Trump? Does it hang on, you know, the Surgeon General, Jerome Adams, Anthony Fauci? I don't know. But it's going to define him in the future. As, you know, as we look back on this, that's a defining moment for Mike Pence. And, you know, he led it the way that he governed Indiana, frankly, very hands off. I mean, he was part of everything, but he's not a strong executive, I'll put it that way.
Tom, in our last couple of minutes, I wanted to ask a little bit about his future as part of the future of the Republican Party. There's the question of, is it a Trump party now? Is it a post-Trump party? How much does Mike Pence's political future as a Republican hinge on that question?
Yeah. I mean, if you told me that, you know, Pence almost got exiled to like never Trump status with that, unfortunately for him, it's hard to tell. Things are so fluid right now. You know, some people will tell you that this Republican support for Trump is softening. Other people will tell you that it's still rock solid. When I talk with my sources around different campaigns around Washington, what I tend to hear the most from the Republicans is that it's just impossible to tell right now. You know, one thing that we do know is that Trump is not having the bullhorn of Twitter and Facebook to use. It's really kind of tamped things down quite a bit. And it's actually allowed people to really kind of catch their breath and try to figure out where they're going. Now, there's a couple tests I'm watching for right now. Number one is if somebody gets in a primary against Liz Cheney, the Wyoming Republican who voted to impeach Trump. You know, does that, you know, is there a strong challenger? You know, does it turn into like a Jeff Flake type of situation where, you know, he spoke out against Trump and then immediately gets primary and, you know, steps out before he could lose. I don't know. It's hard to tell right now. Things are very fluid on the Republican side, you know, and frankly, in a way that they were not, you know, like 1 p.m. on January 6th. I mean, you know, at that point, Trump was still the de facto front runner for 2024 for the party. Hard to tell if that's the case anymore. I mean, January 6th just flipped everything on its head in so many different levels, you know, not least of which was Republican Party politics. So just a lot to watch right now and nothing settled.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Tom LoBianco, Washington correspondent for Business Insider. He's the author of the book Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. He joined us for a look back at Mike Pence's term as vice president and the rocky ending with his running mate. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, food share recipients are seeing a boost in benefits and some new options in how they are able to use them. You can find out more about that tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then it's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. On the table, we'll take a look at how the impeachment trial for former President Trump is moving forward in the Senate after a failed vote to say that it was unconstitutional to bring that trial in, given that President Trump is out of office. but it's a big sign that Republicans aren't going to be too willing to convict the president along the way. Plus, we'll take a look at the argument over whether or not to get rid of the Senate filibuster and what's happening with President Biden's COVID relief package in Congress. It's the Week in Washington. That's coming up next. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Thank you.